Chapter 4. Perrault's approaching departure brought a rush of activity to the castle. The retiring Lord Deputy was determined, it seemed, to go out in a blaze of glory. Countless farewell pageants were organized for him, and largely by him, and the road between the wharfs and the gate towers became choked with well-wishers arriving to pay their respects. Hugh and his friends watched the daily comings and goings from their prison window. They were not deceived by all the seeming goodwill. "Well-wishers, is it?" scoffed Donal. "And Dublin Castle bulging at the seams with all their hostages. Your man would do anything to impress his sister. Even Fiach MacHugh is after receiving a safe conduct, I hear. And three of his sons in Perrault's hands to make sure he accepts," added Hugh bitterly. "Well, I'll tell you this for nothing. The English Queen may believe this show of duty, but it will not fool anyone here. The only Irishman who shed unforced tears for Sir John Perrault is old Turlough Lunach, and sure he'd weep at the parting company with his own spit and he in his cups." They all laughed. "Ah, well," said Donal philosophically. "At least your father will be here, Hugh Rowe, and you'll have the chance to see him." Hugh frowned. Donal was right, but there was one thing he seemed to have forgotten. The old Donal would come to Dublin no more willingly than Fiach MacHugh O'Byrne. He, Hugh Rowe, would be the knife held to his father's throat, and that knowledge was a bitter thing to swallow. He blamed himself also for the current trouble in Tyrconnell. Visitors to Dublin reported that since his abduction, the ambitions of his father's would-be successors had erupted into violence again. One of the claimants, Hugh MacCalvagh, had apparently allied himself with the O'Neill to inflict a crushing military defeat on the O'Donnell and his ally, Hugh MacFurdo. The pretender had not survived long enough to profit from his victory, but in the meantime, the O'Donnell's uncle, Hugh MacHugh Dove, and his nephew, Niall Garve, were both rattling their own swords, and Donal O'Donnell, well, he was quietly gathering supporters and waiting for his opportunity. The country was falling into anarchy, and under cover of the confusion, a group of English soldiers had attacked Donegal Friary and installed themselves in its cloisters. Hugh had happy memories of Donegal Friary. He had heard mass in its chapel, stolen apple from its orchards, received religious instruction from its garden. To think of it now, destroyed by drunk heretics, its occupants slain or scattered God knows where, it was a pain almost beyond bearing. Time and again, he cursed himself for the naive idiot he had been at Rathmullen. The O'Donnell and his wife rode into Dublin one afternoon in mid-May. They were giving lodgings in the castle, and the following morning Hugh was brought to their apartments to visit them. It was an uncomfortable reunion. He looked at his father, so visibly aged in the short time since they had last been together, at his angry, tight-lipped mother. And did she not know what to say? "Is it me she's angry with?" he wondered. "Does she blame me for this mess?" To make matters worse, his parents were not alone, and when Hugh saw who the other visitor was, his heart sank. The O'Neill! Hugh had never felt easy in this man's presence. There was something too subtle, too un-Irish about him, and it was not simply his English title, Earl of Tyrone. Hugh was a secretive man. He thought much and spoke little, which made it difficult to read his mind, and Hugh Rowe was not used to such restraint. The Inian Dove never left anyone in doubt as to her feelings. She was well known for her rage. The O'Donnell didn't mince his words either. And when Owen's father, or Donal's, lost his temper, the whole world knew about it, but the O'Neill smiled and dissembled. He never raised his voice. The man who crossed him might never realize his mistake until he felt the knife between his ribs. In his presence, he had always felt very young and very inadequate. He sensed the man's gaze on him now and tried to ignore it as he walked forward to greet his father. The O'Donnell held his hands out.
Ah, Hugh, ah, son, isn't it grand to see you again?
His voice was that of an old man's. Hugh could not answer. Shame and guilt strangled the words in his throat. He clasped the old man's hands and kissed him on the cheek as duty allowed. His eyes sought his mother. Help me, he begged silently. Support me, forgive me, or am I done for? Tall and imposing as the Morrigu, the Inneen Dubh regarded her son in silence. Then, suddenly, she too held out her arms, and her fierceness dissolved into a loving smile.
No shame to you, my hero, she said softly. Aren't we all after being deceived by the English treachery?
His defences crumbled. Pride, shame, dignity dissolved like icicles in the rain. He went into her arms and wept there like a child. Nobody jeered. Nobody mocked him. And afterwards, words came more easily. Fear for himself turned into concern for her own safety.
You should not be here, he told her. It's not safe for you here. Not after.
She chuckled.
You mean after what happened? They told you of that, did they?
He nodded. His mother shrugged. Ah, well. And little enough there was to tell. If you go to that of it. He died. He came to Mongalvan after the battle, boasting of his victory, and died there, in a drunken brawl.
The English say it was murder, and you after ordering it.
He was their creature. It pleases them to believe so. Hugh MacCalva was a traitor who took arms against his chieftain. He paid the price for it. She made it sound so simple, but he knew better.
And what defence will that be? He demanded, once the English are after arresting you.
They'll not arrest me. I have the personal assurances of the Lord Deputy.
The word of an Englishman?
They all laughed, but it was Hugh O'Neill who answered him.
You are learning fast, Hugh MacRoe, he said approvingly. But bear in mind, your mother is not the only one here under a guarantee of safe conduct. How would Fiach MacHugh take it, do you think, if Perrault were to go back on his word? I'll tell you. He would be away to the mountains as fast as his horse could carry him, and every other chieftain who valued his skin hot in his heels, he chuckled. And then, who would be left to line the banks of the Liffey and give the old fool his grand farewell?
Hugh had to smile.
All the same, though.
Forget it,
said his mother, shaking her head.
It's over, done with, one less dog to worry about.
But there will be others.
And they all go in the same way.
Her confidence was inspiring. But suddenly anger rose like a wave inside of Hugh.
I should be with you, he raged. I should be leading your army. And so you will be. Have patience, my son. They cannae keep you here forever.
But they could. And they all knew it as well as he did. He looked down a dark, long tunnel into the future.
They have me like a fly in a spider's web, he said bitterly, and they'll not let me go till they're after sucking the life from me. Stop it!
The Inneen Dubh gripped him by the shoulders and shook him hard.
Stop it at once! Is it a child you're to be, talking this foolish way?
We are not after deserting you, Hugh,
put in Hugh O'Neill.
There are ways out of this castle, and I know not without the friends and resources to find them.
And they, after trying and failing once already, didn't Perrault boast to me himself that you were after offering him £1,000 for my escape, and he refusing you?
He had the truth of it, the man admitted. But Perrault is a wealthy man, with little need of money, and frightened half to death that harrion of a sister of his. The incoming Lord Deputy, God rot his soul, is another thing entirely. Sir William Fitzwilliam.
His mouth twitched into a sneer.
We had him once before. He was greedy then, and I'll wager he's still greedy now. A weasel doesn't change its nature. Give him time to settle in, and we'll see what a little tickle on his palm will do. Meanwhile, let you not think that he is the only horse in my stable. I'm already after writing to Lord Burleigh and Sir Francis Walsham. They're influential men, privy councillors, both of them, and both be owing me favours.
Hugh felt ashamed.
I'm sorry, he said. You're doing your best. It's not my place to be complaining. Only, he sighed.
How could he explain what it was like to spend your days shut away behind high walls, to watch the world pass you by through one small window, to depend on your captors for the most basic of necessities?
Sometimes, he said, I'm hard-pressed not to beat my brains out against the wall.
I understand, said Hugh O'Neill. Prison is hard for any man, and you're very young. But have faith in me. I will plead for you, lie for you, anything it takes. Sure, didn't I even tell Walshingham that you're my son-in-law? I need you free, Hugh Rowe. Tyrconnell needs you free, and we will not fail you. Let you trust in that.
Hugh blinked. That must be the most impassioned speech he had ever heard the man making. But what did it mean? He could understand his importance to Tyrconnell, but why would Hugh O'Neill need him so badly? He searched his mind for a glimmer of understanding. The chieftaincy? The O'Neill title? Of course, that was it. For Hugh O'Neill to set his own foot on the inauguration stone when Turlough Lunnich died, he would need all the backing that he could muster. A strong and friendly Tyrconnell would be crucial to his success. Wasn't it for that the man was after marrying one of O'Donnell's daughters? It explains something else, too.
Did you really tell Walsham I was your son-in-law?
He asked the would-be O'Neill curiously.
I did, admitted his champion.
And which of your daughters am I supposed to be after marrying?
Well, let's see now. The man put his head to one side and pretended to consider the matter carefully. I have not many left now, you mind, and they unmarried. But Roche's about your age. On consideration, sure, I think you'd do very well together.
And he was almost speechless. And Roche, what has Roche got to say about all this?
Ah, well now, Hugh tipped him a broad wink. Won't you have to ask her that yourself?
The next 6 weeks passed quickly. Sir John Perrault was flattered by all of his guests. He made a pompous speech to the hostages, telling them how fortunate they were to be locked up in Dublin Castle, where none could accuse them of treason. And finally, he sailed down the Liffey to the cheers and tears of a large crowd. The cheers were universal, but whether they were appreciation or relief, nobody would say. The tears were supplied by Turlough Lunnich. And he so full of wine. Isn't it running out of him at both ends? Observed the Inning Dove, describing the pageant to her son. Hugh could imagine it, and he was glad that he had been spared the sight. At last the time came for their final meeting. With Perrault gone, the Inning Dove no longer felt safe in Dublin. Hugh had not realized how much this leave-taking would affect him, but as he kissed his mother farewell, he felt an overwhelming surge of homesickness. They were going home, back to the mountains, the salmon streams, the green, forest places of Tyrconnell, and he must remain here, imprisoned like an eagle in a cage. He struggled to keep his feelings hidden, but there was no deceiving the Inning Dove. She put her hands on his shoulders.
Courage, Hugh Rowe. Have faith in us. We will not fail you. No matter what it takes, no matter what it costs, there is nothing we will leave undone, and it's serving to bring you home again.
He carried her words back to the gatehouse, and tried to believe in them, as he sat on the windowsill and watched the rain.